It's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table. I hadn't thought about the word resourceful for a long time until I was reading British food writer Tamsin Day Lewis's cookbook. The subtitle is something about good food for resourceful cooks. Aren't you fed up with hearing about being frugal? I mean, it feels so grim. It feels like you're being put into shackles. Resourceful, on the other hand, is something to be proud of. It means you're smart, you're clever, and you're not bowing your head. Resourceful is looking at some stale bread, some eggs, a bit of milk, a clutch of limp vegetables, and seeing a great bread pudding for supper. So today, it's all kinds of resourcefulness. This hour, on The Splendid Table. Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media. Today, we're looking at resourcefulness of all kinds, from all kinds of places. British food writer Tamsin Day Lewis has a rather militant stand on how and why to cook at home. There's an adoring newlywed sourcing breakfast for his bride. We hear the story of how one woman's loss of smell changed everything, and taste being the least of it. And we even take a look at the most resourceful trend of all, indoor composting. And of course, we're going to be talking with you. So lots more is coming your way this hour. There's that moment between couples when that first flush of married love is going full tilt. Nothing comes close to this. You're brimming over with the desire to treat the beloved as the most cherished being on earth.
In the night, a dream that can be heard. Isn't it romantic?
I just wanted to make breakfast for Renee. I wanted to surprise her. It was 5 a.m, and it was cold out. We had no food in the house, and I just wanted to get pancake mix and maybe some bacon, so I thought, I'll just stop at the end of the block at the Friendly Mart.
I was asleep the whole time. I just had no idea. I was in dreamland.
I pull up to the side of the Friendly Mart. I just kind of ease right in, and I looked around the store, and I looked for bacon, and it was too expensive. It was like $4.99 for a thing of bacon. I was like, well, I don't know. That seems a lot of money.
What I do remember is the alarm going off, and he comes in and turns off the alarm clock, and he says, hey, I've made breakfast for you. We got pancakes. And I said, oh, great. And he said, yeah, and I went to the store, and I got Spam. He goofs around a lot. He's a joker. So I just completely thought he was kidding.
And she says, you're kidding, right? And it was right in there. I was just like, oh, no. And she's like, oh, no, that's okay. Sure, I guess, fry it up.
And then I realized, okay, you have to take this seriously, Renee. There actually is Spam in your house right now, and you're going to be called upon to eat it shortly. What are you going to do?
I go back into the kitchen, you know, and then I open up the can, and I'm not feeling that great about it. I'm like, oh, well, just open it up, and I'll make it anyway. I guess I have to make a mistake sometime. But I try real hard. I slice them thin, and I try and cook them to their crisp.
he cooked it. He fried it right up, just like you would eat bacon. And I stumbled out and I had it for breakfast. And it wasn't that bad. It was kind of dense, but it was salty. I like salty things. I ate it, a slice or two.
You ever see that Charlie Chaplin silent movie where they eat a shoe? It was kind of like that. You know, it was a salted sole of shoe.
Did any red flags go up in your head when you were looking at this spam thinking, I'm about to buy this?
Well, yeah, you know. I felt bad, kind of quibbling in my mind over just a couple bucks.
How much was the spam?
That was about, it was about $2.50 for the thing of spam, which was, you know, reasonable. That's what I wanted to pay for bacon.
It did sort of shed light on a very subtle difference between him and me, because I just wouldn't buy spam, and he would. Maybe every couple there's a spam dichotomy between the two of them that they don't even know about.
So my penance was 15 hail spams. That was going to be my act of contrition. Whatever a hail spam is.
Could you try one right now?
Hail spam, full of grace, the pork is with thee.
That piece was produced by Renee Gutel, and at this point, she and John have a son, Miles, who is an adventurous eater, but spam has not yet passed his lips. You know, at the top of the show, I was talking about being resourceful, and I mentioned bread pudding. Well, it came to mind because everything I'm seeing now in the market says to me, bake me in a pudding. Peas, leeks, new greens, spring cheeses. Now, since bread puddings can come from anything you've got on hand, I thought it'd be great to talk about how to improvise one. So it's about using up bits and pieces. So here's how you do it. First, you tear up some bread and you put it in the bottom of a baking pan. I like to use whole grain bread. You know, it's healthier and it tastes better. Next is the cheese. Now you can use all the bits and pieces and odds and ends that you have, or you can just mix a sharp cheese like cheddar with something really mild like ricotta. You dot that all over the bread. Next comes the vegetables. Now this can be almost anything. Think of pairing stuff though, like tart greens, sweet peas, and throw in a lot of fresh herbs. That goes on top of the cheese. Now finally there's the custard, and this is a really simple formula. You want 2 eggs for every cup of milk. And you throw in some salt and pepper and some nutmeg to taste. Well, you really shouldn't taste it. There's raw eggs. But I'd say a quarter of a teaspoon of nutmeg is too much. A little less than that. Now you cover the pan. You bake it in a 350-degree oven until you get a reading at its center when you stick in an instant reading thermometer of 170 degrees. Now, at that point, you can serve this thing hot, warm, or at room temperature. It reheats beautifully, makes a great breakfast, and makes a great supper. Now, we're going to put this guide up on the website, but it's improvisation. It's going to be up to you to make up your own recipe. You're going to find it, you know where, splendidtable.org. Jane and Michael Stern perform a public service, and that public service is terribly important at this time of year. Just when we're all starting our road trips, this is when we really need to know about all those little local places that the guidebooks never mention, except Jane and Michael's. They do roadfood.com. The site is dynamite, and they report in here just about every week. Hey, Jane, Michael, what's up?
Fish camps in Florida. We have been exploring one of the greatest phenomena of road food. The fish camp, you know, it's not really a restaurant. It's sort of a whole community. And in Florida, it can be one of the best places to eat real, true, non-farm-raised catfish.
Now, when you say a community, is this, what, is it like a resort usually?
It's
vacationers go there. Campers go there.
You can camp there. You can pull your boat up there. You can go fishing there. You can park your Harley there. You can get your hair done at the hairdresser there. The kids can, you know, those claw machines that a lot of restaurants have where, you know, you put in
a quarter, and you try to get the prize out of the center.
Let me just to give you a sense of what Whitey's character is like. The claw machine at Whitey's, it's a $2 claw machine. And the claw goes down and you actually try to pick up a live lobster from the claw machine.
$2 claw. I would give that a shot.
Whitey's, I mean, just to put it bluntly, Whitey's is the most kind of politically, nutritionally incorrect restaurant I can possibly think of.
The words redneck Riviera come to mind. Yeah.
So what's the food like?
Well, it's a huge menu at Whitey's, but the specialty of the house and the reason probably 9 out of 10 people go there is for all-you-can-eat catfish. And they make a big deal at Whitey's, and it is a big deal, that these are not farm-raised. These are wild-caught
catfish.
These
are the real funky, bottom-feeding, big whiskers.
Oh, yeah.
These are catfish the way Floridians would want to eat
But
catfish.
They do not need any of the kind of character building that farm-raised ones do. These are simply, you know, lightly breaded in cornmeal and deep-fried, and they're served whole. So, but, you know, catfish are very easy to eat off the skeleton. You just poke your fork in and pull off a big hunk of that juicy meat, have some hush puppies on the side, and you have got a real Florida feast.
Do you know the acronym AYCE?
No, I don't.
That's shorthand for all you can eat.
I see.
They keep bringing the catfish as long as you want to keep eating it. And one of the nice things is you can specify, once you've had a plate or two, what size cats you want. In other words, if you want the big ones or you dig your fork in and fork up a big hunk of meat, you can do that. Or you can ask for the very tiny ones. I don't do this. But the really tiny ones, people eat everything but the backbone, you know, because the little teeny-weeny bones are cooked so you can actually eat them.
You know, my friend's brother lives down there, and she said that when he goes to Whitey's, he says he puts on his buffet pants, which is
the ones with the elastic
waist.
So
for the AYCE places, you put on your big elastic waist pants, and you go to work.
Hey, guys, thank you.
Happy
Bye,
eating, Lynn.
Baby, I wish I was a catfish swimming in the deep blue sea. I'd have all you good-looking women swimming after me.
Jane and Michael Stern are the authors of 500 Things to Eat Before It's Too Late. Now, you can get information on Whitey's Fish Camp and their other finds on the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're on the site, sign up for our free e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen, and download some of the podcasts. Check out our Cheap Eats section of our recipe collection and take a look at the rest of the site. It's a big deal, you know, because it's all free. And it's there, splendidtable.org. Coming up, Remembering Smell and Britain's Tamsin Day Lewis. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. Our program is supported by Just Bare Chicken, all natural with no antibiotics, vegetable fed, cage free, traceable to the family farm we're raised. Just Bare Chicken. Go minimal. You can learn more at justbarechicken.com. How would you feel if you knew that you could never again smell that hot buttered biscuit you just bit into? Now, you could eat it again, but no smell, which means nearly no taste. No smell means emotional memories fade, connections to your world get distorted. Well, this is what writer Bonnie Blodgett woke up to one day. Bonnie's a garden expert and cook, but in 2005, she lost her sense of smell and everything changed. Well, Bonnie's written Remembering Smell, a memoir of losing and discovering the primal sense. Bonnie, it's so good to have you here.
So good to be here, Lynn.
So tell me what happened
Okay, well, I had a cold coming on, and a friend of mine had recommended a product which you spray up your nose, and supposedly then whatever it is in this mystery chemical takes away the cold before
right.
it even occurs.
Yeah.
So I knew immediately when I got too much of it up my nose that I had done some serious damage, because the pain was, it was, imagine a blowtorch going up into your nose. It was
Whoa.
Just, I was literally in tears. I actually needed pain relief, you know, to get to sleep. But woke up in the morning, forgot all about it, went on with my life. A few days later, I just noticed things weren't tasting right.
Mm-hmm.
And it took weeks for me to figure out what was going on. But the first symptom was something called phantosmia, which is like phantom limb syndrome.
Uh-huh.
Your brain freaks out and begins producing sort of a smell factory of the most vile scents you can imagine. So everything from rotting fish to burning flesh, sometimes actual smells would set off a novel, awful smell, but they were always awful. They also did not go away. Normally, the brain adapts. And I finally got myself to the right doctor. It took me several doctors before I was diagnosed with anosmia, which is loss of smell altogether. And they gave me a pill that made the bad smells go away. But then I couldn't smell a thing, which was devastating and much different from what I expected.
What did you expect it was coming?
Well, I was just sort of thinking in terms of what would not be there. I couldn't smell food, so therefore I couldn't taste food, because taste is 80 or 90% smell.
Right.
Flavor is really the proper term for taste. And flavor is something that the brain actually creates with the help of the olfactory nerve. It's a terrifically complicated process. And only humans can do this, by the way. Only humans experience flavor. Animals don't. So I knew I wouldn't be able to enjoy food, and I didn't. But there was a disconnect to reality that really more emotionally difficult were the things that were missing from my life that I had never thought about.
Uh-huh.
The smell of my grandfather's wing chair, the books in the library, the smells that you're not conscious of. But they create, along with your other sensory
right.
Experiences, they create your world. And all of a sudden, a big part of your world is gone. I mean, food, taking that away made me pretty miserable.
What did food?
I know.
I mean, I want to say, what did food taste like? But was there any sense of
well, they say
the experience?
It's fun to read what people say about anosmia. You know, there's a lot of talk of, well, you know, you can experience the spiciness and you can experience the sweetness, because those are, you know, your taste buds are still working.
Yeah.
And there is another nerve completely separate from the olfactory nerve that allows us to experience spicy foods.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, yes, indeed, sharp mustard, sharp onions.
Those would come through.
Those things do come through, but they just are so, I mean, disembodied when they're disconnected from the thing that makes them so special, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
The smells.
Yeah. You're a cook, though.
Yes.
How does, what happened?
I just couldn't cook.
Yeah. But you're one of the lucky ones,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
The sense of smell returned.
Yes, it did.
How did it come back?
The cells in the nose are the only ones in the brain, the only neurons that have the capacity to repair themselves, which tells us that smell is so much more important than we think it is.
Huh.
The process is called regeneration or neurogenesis. The cells divide. And if you have the kind of brain injury that completely severs your olfactory nerve, this isn't going to happen, and you're
right.
one of the unlucky ones. But if there's anything left, the cells will grow again. And this isn't true of the cells in the rest of the brain, to our knowledge so far. There's a lot of work going on in this area. But yeah, so I was very lucky.
Is it different now?
It's not quite as acute as it was. I, I think. I'm not sure. I don't care, to be honest.
Yeah.
Because if you can smell a little bit, that's all you need.
Yeah.
You know, your imagination plays a big role in everything. And just to be connected again, just to be, just to know, oh, that's a roast cooking in the oven in the kitchen.
Did it happen all at once or did it happen gradually?
The regeneration took place, I'm sure, over a matter of months. I think it begins right away.
Uh-huh.
I noticed I could smell again one day in May. I was working in my garden, and I noticed the smell of the catmint, which is very strong and sort of pungent. And it was just unmistakable. And I was able to take a bit of a leaf and squeeze it and put it up to my nose. And then I knew. And
wow.
Yeah, I feel like in a way this whole thing was a gift because now I appreciate my sense of smell and I wish other people did too because it's the greatest.
Bonnie, thank you.
Well, thank you, Lynn. It was just great to be on your show.
Bonnie Blodgett is author of Remembering Smell, a memoir of losing and discovering the primal sense. Well, how about the scent of fresh bay leaves, spring vegetables, and white beans? Take a look at that recipe, spring vegetables with white beans and fresh bay. It's on the website, splendidtable.org. And take part in our seed conversation. We're collecting stories about seeds, and we'd love to hear from you. So check it out. It's on the site, splendidtable.org. We Americans had our so-called food revolution in the 1970s, and revolts keep happening. The UK had theirs a tad later, but their food pros are smarter than ours. They behave like they invented French and Italian food. We're still jumping up and down about discovering it. Well, Tamsin Day Lewis is one of England's kitchen sensualists, and she's quite staunch on the idea that only good food is worth our time. With no part of the world immune to money problems, Tamsin has risen to the economy with her book, Supper for a Song, Creative Comfort Food for the Resourceful Cook. Tamsin, welcome.
Thank you.
You know, I'm thinking about what we're all going through over these past couple of years, and I think it may be the same in England, isn't it, where people really have to cut back?
They have to cut back, but often they're not educated to cut back because they can't cook and they can't shop. And in my book, the best and most creative food one can ever cook is from leftovers. So it's about stretching what you've got and not making meat the centrepiece of the dish. Nobody in France, Italy, Greece, Spain, the countries that really understand peasant cooking and cuisine de terroir, you know, the food that comes from the land.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in Italy, in the south, for example, in Puglia, they make use of bitter weeds and bitter herbs and lots of vegetables. And meat is a treat. And it doesn't have to be the centrepiece. And actually, you know, none of us can afford to go on eating meat because we can't go on affording in real terms, in terms of land and carbon emissions, to go on rearing so many beasts. So really, the alternative is cereal crops, vegetables, fruit.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a question of knowing how to cook some very basic, simple things and not throwing things away.
Yeah, there is this business about we throw away so much.
Well, in England, supposedly, we throw away 30% of what we eat, which I find shocking, because we have people saying we can't afford to eat fruit and vegetables or buy decent organic meat. And in fact, they could do if they bought the cheaper cuts of meat. And if they didn't throw away, in English terms, £450 worth of food a year
wow.
for an average family, which in your terms is, what, $650 worth of food?
Yeah.
Well, if
yeah.
you can afford to do that, you can actually afford to eat a whole lot better.
It's a very good point. Give me an example of something, you know, you make from nothing.
Well, I've written a whole chapter called Use Your Loaf, and that's because we don't. What we do is we buy a loaf of bread and then we throw 3/4 of it away or give it to the birds. We don't say cut half it up and put it in the freezer, turn it to breadcrumbs, use it for a gratin. If you look at all the great European traditions in food, you have bread used to thicken soups.
Mm-hmm.
You've got Italian lovely fresh summer salads, which you would have all your heritage tomatoes in America. So you have those and cucumbers and peppers and whatever you want to put in them, olive oil. And you have stale bread,
right.
put a bit of good olive oil on, splash it on, a few herbs, and you've got a fabulous summer salad. The same with my main course chicken. Just use the wings or the thighs and make a sauce with fried bread. in olive oil and garlic and saffron and a bit of thyme and some lovely Marcona almonds. You've got a thick, enriched sauce without using flour. Uh-huh. And you've got a fantastic Spanish chicken recipe for nothing. And you can do crisps. Well, you have crisps, we have Betty's. So with all your summer fruits, be it blackberry and apple or raspberry and red currant or strawberries or cherries, just use your stale breadcrumbs with a bit of cinnamon and sugar, fry them in butter in a pan. You've got that lovely texture of the crisp, cinnamony, sugary crumb and the fruit beneath. Whatever fruits are to hand, you know, beg, burgle, climb up a tree. It's not expensive. Pick.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. What about the reality, though, of very little time? I mean, more people now are working than before. Many people have two jobs. And the kind of cooking that you're talking about, in some cases, takes time.
I don't agree at all. I think that's the worst excuse. It's no excuse. I've got three children, a full-time job, been on the road filming for 15 years of my life. I never didn't cook a good dinner, even if I got home at 8:30 at night or had to cook things in advance at a weekend. I think it's a totally false economy in terms of time and taste and goodness to try and sell people the notion of quick food. Because actually, a lot of slow food takes a short amount of time to prepare, and then you cook it slowly, or you cook it overnight, or you cook it half one day, and then you finish it off the next day. So it's those basic skills that our grandparents had, but maybe a whole generation lost when the supermarkets, who were to blame in my estimation, provided us with ready-cooked, ready-made, you know, processed, ghastly, you know, heat-and-eat dinners.
When you really can stretch out, when you've got all the time in the world, what do you love to cook?
It is entirely dependent upon the seasons. I look forward to every single thing. So at the moment in England, we've got the Vale of Evesham asparagus. And asparagus, I believe, keep it away from water. I actually cook it in a bit of olive oil, so it retains wonderful, vibrant green texture, little bit of lemon zest, olive oil. Again, it's an untemperamental food, so where you're talking about a long time, you can cook it in advance and eat it warm. And I think people get fussed about having hot food. When it's hot, you need more spices, curiously. So I cook a lot more spicy foods in the summer, barbecued things with lots of either Middle Eastern spices or Indian spices, but they are better at room temperature. Even a tart, for example, you would never eat hot, or you can't taste the flavour. So if you're making a summer tart, which I did last week, with fresh peas and a bit of asparagus and some broad beans just coming out into the garden now, a little bit of goat's cheese and some fresh herbs from the garden, again, very, very cheap. Wait 20 minutes and eat it warm, and you get the flavours.
Mm. Tamsin, thanks so much for talking with us.
Pleasure.
Tamsin Day Lewis is author of Supper for a Song, and she's got an ideal dish for right now, crushed peas with feta and scallions. It's on the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, take a look at the Splendid Table store. You're going to find products related to cooking and baking.
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service I can render. Tell the one who loves you only, I can be so warm and tender. Call me, don't be afraid, you can call me. Maybe it's late, but you call me, tell me and I'll be around.
It is time for us to talk. You can reach us, go to splendidtable.org, shoot us an email, or call 800-537-5252. Anything you want to talk about. Okay, let's see. We have Susanna calling from Raleigh, North Carolina. Susanna, what do you want to talk about?
Lynn, well, I am hoping that you can give me a little bit of premarital counseling.
I beg your pardon.
Don't worry, it's food related.
All right, okay.
I'm getting married in July to a Canadian carnivore, is the only way I can describe him. And I'm wanting some ideas for dinner that will satisfy both of us. And here's the hitch. We are both applying to PhD programs, so I guess if all goes well, we will be on a tight budget.
Right. Now, what kind of food do you like?
Well, I consider myself, I guess, an opportunitarian. I'm kind of into whatever is most interesting, but I lean toward green.
So you're saying what's going to make him happy and what's going to make you happy. Is he a meat and potatoes man? I mean, does he have to have his meat as a chunk of meat on the plate, or is it okay if the meat is part of something else?
Yeah, well, he grew up Dutch-Canadian, and so he's used to having meat and potatoes, but he to his credit, he has a pretty adventurous palate, so I think he would take it however it comes.
What comes to mind is there are so many great combinations you could do. Let me give you an instance. Suppose you took sausages that he really likes.
Okay.
You put them on the grill, but at the same time you put on the grill whole leaves of chard that you've tossed. You could do chard.
Or sweet kale, maybe?
Kale is a little tougher for grilling because you usually need to cook it a little bit more. The thing with kale is the leaves are thick and they tend to be very chewy.
Okay.
But if you parboil them, just drop them in boiling water for 2 minutes and pull them out. They're going to get charred. And when they get charred, they're just delicious. Yeah. But you just need to soften them very slightly. Okay. But my thought is that you could take a mess of vegetables where greens are featured, like sweet pepper, zucchini, lots of onion, garlic, your greens, and they either get wrapped in foil with your favorite herbs or your favorite seasonings and go on the grill next to those sausages or the steak or the chop, and they're cooked as the other cooks, but they're steamed in their own juices, or you actually put them on the grill and let them get crispy.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I like the sound of that.
It could be delicious. And then the way you would serve that is you could make, for instance, an uncooked sauce. And do you like spicy things? Do both of you like spicy?
We both do.
You do. Well, you could take a little bit of chili, you know, even take chili flakes if you wanted to. Mix that with a little bit of olive oil, some fresh lemon juice, and some fresh oregano. And then what you do is you streak that all over the plate, and then you plop these things on top of it. And you can be feasting on the veg. He's going to get the veg, too, but he gets his meat. And you may want a taste of the meat. But you
Sure. I like meat. I just like it in moderation.
Exactly. And this way, you guys are doing something where very gradually you can keep cutting back on the meat and increasing the vegetables, and you can season them in any number of ways.
That's sneaky, Len. I like that.
Sneaky's my middle name.
Thanks so much, Len.
Congratulations on the marriage.
Well, thank you.
Take care, Susanna.
Take care.
Call us 800-537-5252 or shoot us an email, splendidtable.org. Well, now is the moment you've been waiting for. It is time for this week's trivia challenge. Now, the big question this week is, what is the most popular recipe on the Splendid Table website? I'm going to be back in a moment with that answer, and we're going to talk. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is supported by Novo Nordisk, committed to changing diabetes through treatments, partnerships, and education. Defeating diabetes is our passion and our business. Now, we're going to be talking with you in a moment. You can get to us by email, splendidtable.org, or use the phone, 800-537-5252. But before we dig in, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what is the most popular recipe on our website? Well, it's not the chicken gizzard candy with ketchup and Coke from How to Eat Like a Republican or Thomas Keller's potato hash with bacon and onions. The most hits by a wide margin go to Margherita Pizza from Naples. It is pure Italy in all its glory. Now, the Italian PR types claim that the pizza was originally invented in honor of Italy's first queen, Queen Margherita, and it was supposed to look like the Italian flag. So you've got red in the tomatoes, you have got white in the mozzarella, and you have got green in the basil. Now, you sprinkle that with olive oil, and you put that into an oven that's hotter than Hades, and you have incredible eating. And by the way, you can do it on the grill. So you can find the recipe, splendidtable.org. Dan is on the line from Lake Balboa, California. Dan, what do you want to talk about?
Well, Lynn, yes, I love your show, and you're my encyclopedia.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Well, let me go back. Bear with me for a minute.
Sure.
In 1982, I bought two jugs of vinegar. One vinegar made from champagne wine.
Right.
The Beaufort 7%.
Beaufort, B-E-A-U-F-O-R-T?
F-O-R.
F-O-R. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Because that's a, if I remember correctly, that's a pretty neat outfit. They make good vinegar.
There. It was swell. And I also bought a red wine vinegar that's aged in oak barrels, also 7%, also Beaufort.
Right, okay.
And these are 1 gallon, 1 quart plastic containers.
Uh-huh.
Well, I used it happily for a number of years, cerveche, any one of a number of things. And then in 1987, I moved to California, and I had some help moving.
Right.
Unfortunately, a couple of my assistants were somewhat kitchen challenged, and they packed these two jugs in a box that was labeled storage.
Oh, golly. I had a feeling this was coming.
Yeah.
So that box hasn't been opened since 1987?
It went to a storage facility, and it stayed there. Oh, now, it's been there all these years. It's number one, it's old vinegar, and with this type of vinegar, I don't know if it improves with age or it starts growing things.
Mm-hmm.
And what effect will plastic have on it?
Okay. I'm not a scientist, so I'm not sure about the plastic effect, but I'll offer you, let's put it this way, an educated opinion.
Okay.
Number one, if the plastic were not a factor, the fact that the vinegar is that old, I would taste it and see what it tastes like. Okay, because
that was wonderful.
Yeah, if it does, and you know, if vinegar is concentrated and you want to dilute it slightly, because it as it evaporates, it concentrates, obviously, you add water to it. And I've had vinegars stashed away downstairs in the cellar, kind of a similar situation. I mean, I've used vinegars that were 15 years old. They were sealed. They were in bottles. My real concern is the plastic and the fact that an acid has been stored in the plastic. An acid really is powerful stuff. And on that note, although I hate to say this because this is from one of the great vinegar makers of France, I wouldn't use it because we don't know how that plastic has ended up, you know, getting, you know, leached into it and whatever. And I hate to say it, but toss it. I think
I was
it's
afraid
safe...
that was going to be.
Yeah, I know. I know. It's a bummer. If it had been in glass, I would say go for it, but it's not. So you know what? You got great pleasure out of that vinegar until, what, 1987? You had great vinegar there, and it was wonderful. And you know what? It's still out there, so you can treat yourself.
Yes, I'm sure I can find them again, but I will have to part with these.
I know. Hey, you know, I think everybody's had this kind of thing happen at one point or another. That bottle of wine you save forever, and then when you finally open it, it's vinegar.
Yes, right.
Hey, Dan, though, thanks for calling. I'm sorry for the bad news.
Thank you for being there anyway.
Well, you're welcome. Thanks a lot. Bye.
Bye-bye now.
You can call us 800-537-5252 or send us an email. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. We got an email from Susie in Washington, D.C. This is what she said. I've ordered for the first time a grass-fed chicken roaster. Now, I'm used to the supermarket variety. Is the cooking method going to be the same? Well, I have to tell you, I've cooked both kinds of chicken on and off for a long time, and there isn't a big difference. Now, granted, your chicken may come from a farm where maybe they're on a special diet, but this is what I think you have to remember. The slower you cook protein, the better. So since this is a roaster, it's a big bird, I'd cook it at about 325, and I'd give it about, I would do about 18 minutes to the pound. All right. And the way you know it's done is you tuck an instant reading thermometer in the thickest part of the breast and it should read about 170. And if it isn't brown enough, just run it under the broiler. Flip it over, get it brown on all sides. But here's the most important piece. Give it a 10-minute rest out of the oven before you dig into it. That's going to make it juicy and tender. You're going to love the chicken. And thanks for the email. Good luck, Susie. Call us 800-537-5252 or go online, splendidtable.org. Let's see. We have got Christina calling from Philadelphia. Christina, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I'm calling with a question about lo mein.
The Chinese noodle.
The Chinese noodle. So I recently moved from Portland, Oregon to Philadelphia.
Right.
And part of moving meant changing jobs. And in my job now, I make significantly less money, but I have significantly more free time, which I consider to be a good thing as long as I can rework my budget. And in Philly, I've fallen in love with the lo mein at a particular Chinese restaurant, and I have developed a bit of a takeout habit. And
and you're realizing that maybe
takeout doesn't really fit with the budget.
That's right. Exactly. Exactly.
So I have the time to learn to make my own lo mein, but I lack the know-how. And so I thought I'd ask you.
Okay. Let's talk about the dish. What does it taste like? What's in it?
Well, I just usually get the chicken lo mein. So it's they use a very thin noodle.
Right.
And then julienned carrots and pieces of chicken, a lot of bok choy, some scallion.
Is it spicy? Sprouts. Is it spicy?
It's not spicy. I usually add a little bit of chili to it myself.
Okay. This is the deal with the lo mein. It's a stir fry that you add the noodles to.
Yes. Now, and I've tried a couple times. My challenge is having noodles that are flavorful but not slimy, you know, not saucy.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
And that's what I can't quite figure out.
Well, you know, you cook the noodles separately, right?
Yes.
Yeah. And you drain them really well and you rinse them with cold water to get rid of all the starch. And then there's one little trick that's used a lot in Chinese cooking. You toss them with a few drops or a teaspoon or so of Asian sesame seed oil.
Yes. Okay.
Now,
okay,
not a
that's
lot,
good.
Just enough, because that way it's going to keep them from sticking to each other, but it gives them a light flavor. Now, the real trick is in the stir fry.
Right.
So what you do with a stir fry is there's usually two, if there's meat or fish or whatever in a stir fry, it's two stages. And here's how it works. You generally stir fry the protein first, never more than a pound at a time. But since you're one person, you could be doing a very small quantity.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Right.
You stir fry that first. You get it out of the wok. You wipe the wok out. You heat it up again. You add a tiny bit of oil to the wok, and then you stir fry the vegetables.
Okay.
But how you season is where the fun comes in. So here's
the
deal.
Right, and that's, that's what I'm excited about.
Let's take your chicken. Go out and get yourself a small boned and skinned chicken breast. Now, it's going to be expensive per pound, but you're going to need 4 ounces at most.
Right.
At most. Okay. Now, when you get that home, you're going to cut it across the grain. All right. You know how it's a long, like a tear-shaped thing? You're going to cut across it.
And I could also do this. I could remove the breast from a whole chicken.
Absolutely. It's a much cheaper way to go. And then you could freeze the parts of the chicken. Absolutely.
Exactly.
And by the way,
exactly.
You could do this with chicken thigh, chicken leg. I mean, it doesn't have to be breast.
Right. Okay.
So the idea is now what we're going to do is we're going to toss that with a little bit of egg white, if you choose, or a little bit of cornstarch. And you could add a little teeny bit of soy sauce to that. Now, just set that aside while you chop vegetables, all right? Thin slice everything so it's more or less the same size. Remember, the harder the vegetable, the thinner you want it because it will cook faster.
Uh-huh. Right.
Okay, I'm going to just give you the basics here, okay?
Okay, perfect.
So we're going to cook the meat first. What you're going to do is you're going to get the wok or your pan very hot. Pour in a tablespoon of oil at most, and you'll have some sliced up garlic and ginger. And you're going to stir that in that very hot oil for just a few moments, okay? Then you add the chicken, and you keep tossing it and tossing it. If you don't have soy sauce on it, give it some salt and pepper. You're going to toss it for maybe 2 minutes or until it's just firm.
Okay.
Scoop it out of the pan, put it aside, let the pan cool down a few moments, wipe it out, heat it up again. And now have more ginger and more garlic, all right?
Okay.
And then on the side, you're also going to have stirred together some white wine, some soy sauce, like a tablespoon of each, okay? If you want to, some oyster sauce, which is sort of sweet, right? And
I
really tasty, right? Or, by the way, ketchup is fabulous.
Okay. I sometimes put in a tiny bit of maple syrup.
Well, that's your sweetness. Absolutely. That's your sweetness. But you usually want a little of the soy, a little bit of the wine. And if you want spice, You could even throw fresh hot chilies into the hot oil and stir them around before you add anything else.
Right. Okay.
Okay, but here's the deal. You'll get the wok or the pan hot. Then the oil goes in. Swirl it around. Throw in the ginger. Throw in the garlic. Throw in the hot chilies if you want to.
Okay.
And then stir fry the vegetables. And stir fry them until they're crisp and just beginning to look cooked. Okay?
Right.
And then add those seasoning ingredients and keep stir frying for another 30 seconds to a minute. Throw the meat back into the pan. Stir fry, then add the noodles, and you're home free.
Okay, perfect.
And if you want more sauce, you could have taken about a quarter to a half a cup of canned chicken broth.
Okay.
And stirred those seasonings into that broth. So remember, you can use hoisin sauce, you can use soy sauce, you can use white wine, you can use chili pastes. You can go to town on all of this.
All right.
And once you've stocked up, you're going to have those things for a long time. They'll keep forever.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much, Lynn. This has been just wonderful.
Well, you're welcome.
And I can't wait to try it out.
You're gonna really enjoy it, and it's the best way to use up bits and pieces.
Yes, excellent. Thank you so much.
You are welcome, Christina. You take care.
Right.
Bye.
You too. Bye-bye.
Call us, 800-537-5252. You want to know how to really stretch those odds and ends, you know, those leftover bits? Either make broth, make soup with them, literally turn them into a soup, and then you throw a can of beans into the pot or whatever, or do a stir fry. Really great. And throw in some noodles. Shoot us an email, splendidtable.org, or go to the phone, 800-537-5252. You know, the food magazines and the websites do comparison tests of products all the time, but they've missed the boat on a piece of green equipment we might all want to consider. Roxanne Weber is associate editor of Chow.com, based in San Francisco. And Chow.com did a comparison test of indoor composters. Well, I've got Roxanne on the phone. Roxanne, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
So how did you come to test indoor composters?
Well, we wanted to, I mean, at the time in our building, we didn't have any composting. And we have this great test kitchen, and we did feel like we wanted to be composting. So we started investigating and found that there were actually different devices designed to do this indoors.
So which ones did you end up testing?
We tested three, which were considered to be the most popular indoor composting systems. One was called the Nature Mill, which was an electric one. It kind of looks like a little Apple computer, actually. It's
the
minty green, you know. One was called a Bokashi system, which was basically consists of a bucket and this substance called Bokashi, which is fermented wheat bran with some microorganisms that gets layered with the food waste and kind of ferments it.
Mm-hmm.
And then the third one was your worm bin style composter.
Where the worms do all the work.
Yeah.
And just out of curiosity, the idea of an indoor composter, right, is that you don't smell the composting as it's going on.
That was definitely the goal. Once we started this project, we realized that was going to make or break most of these for us.
Right.
Because you can't really have something sitting in the kitchen that smells like rotting
garbage.
Corpse,
yeah.
As our staff photographer termed one of the units.
Ooh, which one was that? I mean, it doesn't sound like it was one of the winners.
Yeah, that was the Bokashi system, which it's a really interesting system. The concept is kind of interesting because you're fermenting your waste in this bucket, but we found it to be really, really too smelly for indoor use. However, we did get a Chowhound comment chiming in that they had success with it. So perhaps, you know, we should retest this down the line.
So which one won the prize? Which one was your choice?
By far for indoor use, the Nature Mill was the best choice. It's completely automated. It is electric. I mean, like I said, it looks kind of like a little computer. It could fit under a cabinet, and you basically open the top, drop in food scraps, and then it does the work. It mixes it, it heats it, it aerates it, and then like a little light comes on when you have compost, and you pull open a little drawer, and there it is. And
oh, my goodness.
It really produced, I mean, it looks like dirt. It did a really great job.
It does use electricity, though, so how green is it?
Yeah, that was our question. We all felt a little bit weird about that. But when we looked at the specs on the unit, it is a very low energy use, about 5 kilowatt hours a month. So it seemed like it was still pretty reasonable. Right. And it was also made completely of recyclable materials. It could be recycled itself if you ever wanted to get rid of it. So the company did seem to do a pretty good job of creating a green unit, considering that it was electric.
Well, that sounds great. Hey, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you. It's been fun.
Roxanne Weber is associate editor of Chow.com. Find out more about indoor composting, those flower pots are waiting, at splendidtable.org. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. Remember, you can contact us anytime. Number's 800-537-5252, or check out the website, splendidtable.org. You have a great week, and let me leave you with this thought from Stephen King, who said, French is the language that turns dirt into romance. The Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media and supported by Gather.com, the social network where people can make new friends who share their interests. You can meet people who love food at food.gather.com. Now, nearly everything you're going to ever need in life can be found on our website. Of course, the emphasis here is on nearly. The website is splendidtable.org. And also at splendidtable.org is the Splendid Table store, where you can find products related to cooking and baking. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Judy Boudreau and Jennifer Larson. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Brett Baldwin. Our managing producer is Sally Swift. We're going to be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.